Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today we open our show with a report on rising homelessness in our region and here in East County, as well as how you can sign up to volunteer in the annual Point in Time Homeless Count that's coming up on January 27th. As COVID-19 cases surge, fueled by the Omicron variant filling up local hospitals, local colleges and universities have gone back to virtual instruction, and we'll have details. And in the weirdest news story of late, a wayward sea lion waddled onto Highway 94 3 miles inland, where passing motorists came to its aid until SeaWorld rescuers arrived. And it turns out this wasn't the first time this adventurous animal has turned up in some unusual places. Military veteran Joseph Rocha has suspended his congressional campaign due to redistricting changes, but he's announced that he plans to run for the state Senate instead, challenging incumbent Republican Brian Jones. From California News Service, we'll have a report today on actions to protect consumers from surprise medical bills. And then, on our Scammers, Schemers, and Swindlers report, we'll have some tips for customers of Sullivan Solar who were left in the dark when the company abruptly shut down, including a state fund that can help local victims. On Crime Beat, a man killed when he was pushed in front of a train has been identified as a Santee resident, and an arrest has been made for this heinous crime. Rabbit hemorrhagic fever is hopping across our region, and it's fatal in 80% of cases. Find out what you should do if you find a dead wild rabbit, and learn about a vaccine to protect pet rabbits on today's show. Then, from Public News Service, we'll have some national news headlines, including fears of political violence, the deadline to sign up for health care under the Affordable Care Act, OSHA vaccine mandates rolling out, U.S. negotiations with Russia, and congressional members honoring the late Senate leader Harry Reid. And finally, we'll take you on the road to Julian, our region's historic gold rush town, in a replay of one of our Best of East County segments. We'll also have some winter safety tips and a report on a new program to help refugee students attend college. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, where East County matters.
Hundreds of volunteers will fan out across East County the morning of January 27th to count people living on the streets, in parks, and in other open spaces. You can help by visiting rtfhsd.org to sign up and participate. A short online training is required. The count was canceled in 2020 and conducted on only a limited basis last year, making this year's count especially important. The last full count in 2019 found over 1,000 people were homeless in East County, making up 13% of the county's total. Only the city of San Diego had more. That's according to the 2019 Regional Task Force on the Homeless annual report on homelessness. El Cajon accounted for 10% of that total, or 787 people, during the 2019 We All Count Point in Time count, a federal mandate of the Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD. Lakeside had 72 homeless people in 2019, Spring Valley had 67, and La Mesa 46. Lemon Grove and Santee each had 35. 10 were counted in the Alpine Crest Dehesa area. There were also 14 people experiencing homelessness in Ramona, though the county considers that the North Inland region. Both sheltered and unsheltered people experiencing homelessness are counted. There is a vicious cycle between poor health and homelessness. People living unsheltered outdoors are at greater risk of health problems. Poor health can also contribute to homelessness, since those experiencing homelessness often have limited access to healthcare and healthy food. They may also suffer from stress, violence, unsanitary living conditions, and severe weather exposure. Common health problems include malnutrition, mental health issues, substance abuse, wounds and skin infections, and lung diseases including bronchitis, tuberculosis, and pneumonia. Countywide, homeless deaths due to drug overdose are increasing. Accidental overdoses accounted for almost 40% of deaths in 2018, 49% in 2019, and 59% in 2020. How do so many become homeless? Poverty, unemployment, lack of affordable housing, mental health, and substance use issues are key causes. Others include trauma, domestic violence, justice system involvement, sudden illness, divorce, death of a partner or parent, and disabilities. Homelessness disproportionately impacts women and minorities. Almost 70% are white, about the same percentage as the general population. But 23% of the homeless here are black, versus about 5% in the census population. About 70% of the homeless locally are men, while 30% are women. To sign up as a volunteer for this year's We All Count, visit the Regional Task Force on Homelessness in San Diego at rtfhsd.org. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Elijah McKee.
Major colleges, universities, and community colleges across our region have temporarily shifted back to virtual instruction due to the COVID-19 surge fueled by the Omicron variant and holiday gatherings. San Diego State University will start the spring semester with online learning January 19th through February 4th, with a few exceptions. In addition, all CSU students and staff eligible for the booster must have received it by January 18th to be considered fully vaccinated, despite the delay in returning to in-person classes. Although the campus remains open, students are urged to delay returning to campus until February 5th or later. Student services such as healthcare and the library do remain open. The University of California, San Diego is extending its remote instruction through January 30th, with in-person instruction slated to resume January 31st. In-person gatherings are prohibited until then. All student and staff eligible for vaccine boosters must get them by January 31st before returning to the UCSD campus for the winter quarter of 2022. Grossmont and Cuyamaca colleges in East County have also returned to remote operations. A notice posted on the district's website states, out of an abundance of caution, all intersession classes and on-campus services are being moved online. The notice does not indicate when a resumption of in-person classes or services is anticipated. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
It's not every day you see a sea lion on the freeway, the Highway Patrol tweeted after receiving a call on January 7th reporting a sea lion crossing Highway 94 near Interstate 805 in the Fairmont area just west of Lemon Grove. Spring Valley resident Josephine Jandinger was driving east when she saw two Good Samaritans stop their vehicles in the middle of the freeway to direct traffic and help the seal cross multiple lanes. CHP officers arrived and ran several traffic brakes to assure that the sea lion would not be struck by passing vehicles until SeaWorld's rescue team arrived, says Salvador Castro, public information officer for the CHP in San Diego. This isn't the first time this sea lion roamed into an urban area. In early November, the same sea lion was rescued from Harbor Island Drive. The same sea lion has also been spotted on the Mission Beach boardwalk, the Point Loma Naval Base, and near a deli at Mission Bay. How did the sea lion wind up several miles inland onto Highway 94? Eric Ochen, head of SeaWorld San Diego's rescue team, told 10 News that the wayward sea lion may have waddled up the usually dry Choyas Creek bed, a 3.5-mile path from San Diego Bay. The sea lion may have found water after the recent rains, then became lost and wandered up onto the freeway. The sea lion reportedly appeared unharmed by his adventure. However, SeaWorld plans to conduct tests to make sure the sea lion is healthy, then may release him in the next few weeks. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Marie Johnson.
Combat veteran Joseph Rocha has announced plans to challenge State Senator Brian Jones, a Republican, in the newly redrawn District 40, which includes Rocha's home in Escondido. As a result of redistricting, Jones' former 38th district in East County has been split into two districts. The new 40th district includes portions of San Diego, the East County communities of Santee, Lakeside, Ramona, Alpine, Harbison Canyon, Pine Valley, Descanso, and Mount Laguna, as well as North County areas such as Escondido, San Marcos, Poway, Fallbrook, Valley Center, Bonsall, Rainbow, and Paula. Rocha has dropped his campaign for the 48th Congressional District seat held by Darrell Issa after redistricting turned the battleground district into safe Republican territory, according to a statement that he released. Rocha, a Democrat, says he outraised the congressman in the first quarter, earning national and local endorsements. In his run for state Senate, Rocha says he aims to restore California's reputation as the envy of the nation and the world, rather than a place where too many see no option but to relocate, he says. His campaign's values include service, equity, and justice. His priorities include putting families first and honoring promises to service members and veterans. He says he wants to create good-paying jobs, expand opportunities for first-time homebuyers, make childcare more affordable, and assure a first-class education for every student. Other goals include improving access and quality of services and benefits veterans have earned and prioritizing military spouse employment. Rocha also aims to prioritize fighting climate change, adding, "We owe this to our firefighters who are faced with endless deployment cycles to brutal fires, to our seniors who face increasingly deadly summer heat waves, and to the future of our children." Rocha is a Navy enlisted veteran who deployed to the Persian Gulf as a bomb dog handler before he was discharged under the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. After his discharge, he fought to repeal the policy and was a principal witness in the case that ruled Don't Ask, Don't Tell unconstitutional. After completing law school, Rocha returned to service, commissioning as an officer in the U.S. Marine Corps, where he served 7 years as a judge advocate and finished his military career as a prosecutor. Rocha has long had an interest in politics, including interviewing prominent candidates, while interning right here at East County Magazine back in 2008. He covered a debate in the congressional race won by Duncan D. Hunter and won a San Diego Press Club Award for his coverage of Marty Emerald's successful race for San Diego City Council. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This week, the new federal law forbidding surprise medical bills goes into effect, protecting an extra 6 million Californians. In the past, patients could be stuck with a huge bill if they used an in-network facility, but still ended up with an out-of-network provider. The California version of the law, passed in 2016, didn't apply to some people, such as federal employees, who had federally regulated health plans. Rachel Lynn Gish with the nonprofit Health Access says her group recently updated a study that shows California's bill, which was a model for the federal legislation, has benefited patients without the pitfalls that opponents had predicted.
Providers are being paid fairly and on time. There have been very few provider complaints or appeals, and the networks have actually increased, which has improved patient access to care.
Regulations to implement the federal law establish qualifying payment amounts so providers and insurance companies can work things out and stop scaring patients with large, unexpected bills. You can find a fact sheet with more details on health-access.org or the No Surprises Act section of the website for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Lynn Gish says patients still need to pay close attention.
They shouldn't be getting a surprise medical bill, but they should still be vigilant about what their plans cover, what it doesn't cover, what the cost sharing is on their plan, and whether their providers are in or out of their network.
Going forward, advocates are working to protect consumers from surprise bills from ground ambulance services. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Now it's time for East County Magazine's Scammers, Schemers, and Swindlers report, shining a light on shady deals all around us. Sullivan Solar Power's license has been suspended by the State Contractors Licensing Board after many complaints. As we have previously reported, Sullivan closed its operations and stopped responding to customers' inquiries. Fortunately, help is available. If you are a current or past Sullivan Solar customer, the California Solar Storage Association recommends several resources, including a state-run solar recovery fund to help homeowners harmed by a solar contractor, as well as informational sites and access to contractors who can complete unfinished work. The California Contractors State Licensing Board is managing a solar recovery fund to provide recourse for owners of single-family residences who were financially harmed by a solar contractor because of poor workmanship, project abandonment, or unlawful business practices. You can file a solar energy system restitution claim at cslb.ca.gov. That's the California Contractors State Licensing Board, and again, the site is cslb.ca.gov. The same site also has information for customers who may have had mechanics liens filed on their properties by contractors or equipment suppliers that Sullivan did not pay. If Sullivan Solar Power installed an LG Energy Solution battery, formerly called LG Chem, and subsequently contacted you about a recall of that product, you can contact the LG Energy Solution recall hotline at 888-737-8104. Now, if you need help to complete an unfinished solar installation or to service solar equipment installed by Sullivan Solar Power, the California Solar Storage Association has some members who can help. Visit www.calssa.org and click on the Consumer Resources tab, then the Consumer Protection Hotline, to fill out a form and connect with member companies. Sullivan Solar was once one of the fastest-growing companies in America and considered a leader in California's solar industry. But now, in addition to facing multiple lawsuits for allegedly defrauding customers, Sullivan Solar's founder, Daniel Sullivan, is currently in jail awaiting trial on criminal charges of stalking his former girlfriend. He has pleaded not guilty, but a judge has refused to reduce bail set at $1 million, stating that he considers Sullivan to be a flight risk. The company has not yet filed for bankruptcy as of our show taping deadline. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery. This is Miriam Raftery, producer of the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso. Now, if you're listening to today's show online, you may not be aware that an ice storm has damaged the transmitter high atop Monument Peak near Mount Laguna. KNSJ needs your help to get back on the air. You can donate at knsj.org to support people-powered radio for our region.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Elijah McKee with a Crime Beat report. 68-year-old Martin Andara, a resident of Santee, was killed on New Year's Day when he was pushed into the path of a train at the Old Town Transit Center. According to San Diego police, Andara had just gotten off a southbound trolley when another passenger shoved him off the platform without provocation, then fled on foot. Andara was struck by the train and died at the scene. The next day, police arrested 26-year-old Ryan Michael Ruxtellis in Balboa Park near the Naval Medical Center. NBC7 reports the suspect was apparently unsheltered and was unknown to the victim. The motive is unknown.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
A highly contagious disease, which is nearly always fatal to wild rabbits and hares, as well as pet bunnies, has spread throughout San Diego County and the western United States. Rabbit hemorrhagic disease virus type 2, or RHDV2, was first seen confirmed locally in a wild rabbit in Poway, June 2020. Since then, nearly a dozen more rabbits have tested positive for the disease locally. But there are likely many more cases since the state and county lack resources to test the growing number of dead rabbits reported. According to the California Department of Food and Agriculture, the disease has caused dramatic declines in some wild rabbit populations. The fast-spreading virus has moved about 1,500 miles in just 10 months across the Southwest. The first California case was diagnosed in May 2020 in Palm Springs. 2 months later, the virus was detected in six California counties, including San Diego. While there is a vaccine available for pet rabbits, wild rabbits are at great risk. Dr. Deanna Clifford, a senior wildlife veterinarian from the Wildlife Health Lab with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, said the health lab has tested 23 wild rabbits from around the county since that first case in June 2020, with 11 more turning up positive. The wild rabbits found to have died from rabbit hemorrhagic disease, black-tailed jackrabbits, and desert cottontail were in Santee, the Rancho Jamul Ecological Reserve, Borrego Springs, Ramona Alpine, and Campo. As of December 29th, the county has had 149 reports of dead or sick rabbits since the start of the outbreak in 2020. Statewide, 975 reports of dead rabbits have been received. Dr. Clifford said while the wildlife lab tests periodically to see if the disease is still active, it cannot test every animal reported. The Department of Fish and Wildlife reports that the disease is extremely contagious between rabbits and is spread through direct contact with the infected animals, carcasses, bodily fluids, and hair. Food, bedding, water, flies, fleas, and mosquitoes can also carry the virus between rabbits. The virus can stay active for months in the environment or in a rabbit carcass. The incubation period is 1 to 5 days, and rabbits are often found dead with no clinical signs. Rabbits can also be asymptomatic carriers, spreading the disease for months without ever becoming sick themselves. According to the RHDV2.org website, which is dedicated to informing the public about the disease, the virus kills up to 80% of infected animals. While there is no evidence that humans can catch rabbit hemorrhagic fever by direct contact or by eating rabbit meat, people can unknowingly spread the disease if they encounter an infected rabbit. The disease is a real concern for domestic rabbits, says Dr. Andrea Mikulin, a San Diego veterinarian specialist with California Department of Food and Agriculture's Animal Health Branch. She says the disease appears to have become endemic in our region. Dr. Mikulin said that statewide since July 2020, there have been 57 households with domestic rabbit cases of the disease. Since many people have more than one rabbit, the number of infected domestic rabbits is likely far higher. Jennifer Lee with the nonprofit San Diego House Rabbit Society is also urging people to vaccinate domestic rabbits. The group will have a vaccination clinic on January 22nd at its site on Mercury Street. The vaccine is also available through some veterinary clinics in San Diego and East County. The vaccine is a two-shot series given 21 days apart with annual booster shots needed. In addition to yearly vaccinations, the California Department of Food and Agriculture suggests these ways to protect domestic rabbits. Keep your rabbits indoors, no outdoor playtime or living outside. Do not let your rabbit come into physical contact with other rabbits from outside your home. Wash your hands before and after handling your rabbit. Change your clothes if you have come in contact with other rabbits. Disinfect shoes and other objects that may be contaminated. Quarantine any new rabbit in the home for at least 18 days. Use rabbit-safe monthly flea treatments. And contact your veterinarian if your rabbit becomes sick. Signs and symptoms of the disease typically include loss of appetite, lethargy, high fever, seizures, bleeding from the nose or mouth, difficulty breathing, and sudden death. What should you do if you find a dead wild rabbit? The Department of Fish and Wildlife advises handling the body with latex or nitrile gloves. Double bag the rabbit and spray the bag with a solution of 1/2 cup of bleach per 1 gallon of water. Let it dry for 10 minutes, then dispose in the trash or bury the double bagged rabbit carcass at least 3.5 feet deep. After disposal, remove the gloves, bag them, spray that with bleach solution, and discard, then spray the bottoms of shoes or any other surface that came into contact with the carcass. Wildlife rescue groups, including the Humane Society, are taking steps to protect rabbits in shelters. The Humane Society's Ramona Wildlife Center is not admitting any rabbits from the Ramona area, where several cases have been confirmed. The public is asked to help researchers document spread of the disease by reporting any dead wild rabbits. You can file a report by calling 916-358-2790. Again, that number is 916-358-2790. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Marie Johnson.
Next up, we have some national news reports from Public News Service.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We have flu vaccines, and flu kills, I believe, hundreds of thousands of people every year. OSHA's never purported to regulate on that basis.
Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch and other conservatives on the court appear skeptical about OSHA's COVID vaccine or testing requirement for large businesses. It takes effect today, but it could be blocked. During arguments on Friday, Justice Elena Kagan and other liberals seemed overwhelmingly supportive.
The agency has done everything but stand on its head to show quite clearly that no other policy will prevent sickness and death to anywhere like the degree this one will.
The court is also considering a mandate for healthcare workers at facilities with Medicare and Medicaid funding. Meanwhile, Justice Sonia Sotomayor came under fire for suggesting that nearly 100,000 children in the U.S. are hospitalized from COVID-19. On Sunday, the head of the CDC clarified the number is closer to 3,500. Russia's foreign minister is cautioning that talks between the U.S. and Moscow could quickly break down. The two countries meet today in Geneva amid tensions over Ukraine, where Russia has troops on the border. But analysts say Russia sending forces to stop unrest in Kazakhstan makes a Ukraine invasion less likely. President Joe Biden joined key Democrats at a Saturday memorial service for former Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. Former President Barack Obama remembered his colleague.
The Senate and the country benefited from your extraordinary leadership, and I could not have asked for a better, truer friend.
Reid died at age 82 on December 28th. His body will lie in state tomorrow at the Capitol Rotunda. In Senate election news, Wisconsin Republican Ron Johnson and Republican John Thune of South Dakota are both seeking re-election. Johnson is breaking a promise to limit himself to 2 terms. 20 Senate seats held by Republicans and 14 by Democrats are up this fall. Tens of thousands of migrants are now arriving at the southern U.S. border each week, and crossings by unaccompanied children are up sharply. So far in January, the Border Patrol has rescued 50 migrants from an Arizona canal and a locked trailer in Texas. An agency spokesperson says cartels are leaving migrants in hazardous situations at alarming rates. Former Congresswoman and refugee advocate Marjorie Margolis says there's growing frustration.
Some of the Border Patrol just don't know exactly what their job is. And frankly, if I were a member of Congress, I would be asking, what the heck is going on?
Some immigration advocates are critical of the continued use of a Trump-era public health order that is blocking asylum seekers and the court-ordered reinstatement of the Remain in Mexico policy. Margolis emphasizes that the U.S. continues to be a nation of immigrants.
The next generation of folks who come into this country make our heads spin, and we should be so proud of that.
Cole Hemstreet, Contributive Reporting. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast, January the 10th, 2022. I'm Mike Clifford. As the midterm elections approach, experts are warning that political violence could flare up. Not necessarily another attack on the Capitol, but outbursts based on state or local issues.
A report from the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at Cal State San Bernardino found that October 2018, right before the last midterm election, was the second worst month for hate crimes in that decade. Professor Brian Levin, a study co-author, says the lights are flashing yellow.
I know people are talking about civil war. What I'm more concerned about in the short term is regionalized conflicts and aggressions which get punctuated by plots or mass attacks or even attempts to injure or kill public officials.
I'm Suzanne Potter.
Suzanne tells us last year the California State Legislature voted to establish a commission on the state of hate, but it has not yet held its first meeting. The deadline to roll for health coverage under the Affordable Care Act fast approaching, the latest COVID surge might be interrupting plans to sign up, but those involved with the process say there are ways to work around it.
This year's enrollment deadline is January 15th. Louise Norris of the website healthinsurance.org says if you're overwhelmed with the COVID situation and still need to sign up, handling it over the phone is a good option. Even if you can't complete enrollment right away, talking with the navigator might keep that window open.
There might be a case-by-case situation where they can grant you, you know, an extension as long as they get you sort of started in the system.
Online applications are another alternative to meeting with a navigator in person. I'm Mike Moen.
And as the Missouri legislative session gets underway, reproductive health advocates are pushing back against 7 bills that have been filed to restrict access to abortion.
One is nearly identical to the Texas 6-week abortion ban. Supporters of the bill want to allow private citizens to sue anyone who provides or aids someone in getting an abortion and prevent public funds from going to healthcare providers who also provide abortions. Dr. Jen Villavicencio with the American College of Gynecologists and Obstetricians says abortion is a safe procedure that many people have in their lifetimes, and it's important to reduce stigma.
The impact is felt most strongly by people and families who already face challenges accessing general medical care. This includes those who live in rural areas, people from communities of color, and those without financial means to navigate around the mounting barriers to basic health care.
Missouri is among a growing number of states that are aiming to model legislation after the Texas bill, which is being challenged in court but has so far been allowed to stand. I'm Louie Wolke reporting.
This is PNS. To update the industry, nuclear power making the transition toward smaller reactors, but a report from Taxpayers for Common Sense claims federal subsidies to help the industry are a losing bet. More on that from Eric Tigetoff.
Michael Marigos with Taxpayers for Common Sense says there are a slew of supports for the nuclear industry up and down the supply chain.
But the nuclear power industry is by and large struggling. So there's this large dichotomy between what policymakers have hoped would happen through all of the various costly incentives and what is actually happening on the ground.
Part of the push to develop new technology in the nuclear industry is an effort to decarbonize power grids. Nuclear power is seen as a key source of clean energy in this transition. The company NuScale Power is developing its small modular reactor technology at Idaho National Laboratory and has received federal investments. The Department of Energy did not respond to a request for comment before the deadline for this story.
And a new archive series spotlights the legacies of the Heart Mountain in northwestern Wyoming.
Heart Mountain was an internment camp in northwest Wyoming where Japanese Americans were relocated against their will during World War II. It was the subject of a recent PBS TV special and will also be featured in the Alliance for Historic Wyoming's new place-based stories project. Dakota Russell with the Heart Mountain Wyoming Foundation says while the camp closed at war's end, many families who had lost everything they owned after relocation decided to stay in Wyoming.
We should, of course, take away the lessons that we need to learn about injustice and about standing up for democracy that we can take away from this story. But we should also celebrate this community and the contributions they made to the history of our state at the same time.
Widespread misinformation campaigns claimed without evidence that Japanese Americans could not be trusted and cast many as enemy spies. I'm Eric Galatis.
Finally, our Mark Richardson tells us a new report finds ties between groups and individuals who supported and in some cases participated in the January 6th insurrection and those who oppose protecting public lands.
The study by Accountable.us suggests that anti-government extremists who want to end public ownership of land and water in Arizona and other western states have infiltrated the halls of power. Carl Frisch with the nonpartisan watchdog group says many anti-public lands leaders are aligned with violent forces who attempted to overthrow the 2020 election.
Oath keepers and your Cliven Bundys, various lawmakers have been active opposing public lands. In some of those cases, you have people who have endorsed what happened on January 6th. And in some of those cases, you have people who were involved in January 6th.
This is Mike Clifford. Thank you for starting your week with Public News Service, member and listener supported, heard on interesting radio stations. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show. Next up, we're going to play one of our Best of East County favorites for you, taking you on the road to Julian. This episode was recorded a few years ago, but it reflects the pioneering spirit of Julian that still lives on today.
We're on the road in East County, visiting some amazing towns and meeting some incredible people across our region. Welcome to another adventure on East County Magazine's On the Road.
This is Miriam Raftery.
And this is Leon Thompson. Today we're on the road in Julian, California, a historic gold rush town in the mountains of East County, San Diego.
Now back in 1870, the town was founded by Drury Bailey and his cousin, Mike Julian. The two cousins were Confederate soldiers during the Civil War, both taken prisoner by the Yankees. After they got out and the war ended, they found their homeland had been laid waste by General Sherman's march to the sea, so they and other family members decided to head west. But Drury missed the boat to Panama, so he went overland instead. He did some hard rock mining in Montana, but then he ran out of money. So he flagged down a wagon train, and by a fortunate stroke of fate, he found that his brother was the driver. Drury founded the town of Julian in 1870 and named it after his cousin, Michael Julian. Traumatized by the war, Drury wanted to help others start new lives. So he gave away plots of land to anyone who agreed to build a home right away, as well as giving plots away for a school, a church, a jail, a town hall, and a chamber of commerce. Now, it wasn't hard to convince people to move to this remote mountain town, since that same year, Julian resident Fred Coleman reportedly paused to give his mule some water and discovered gold in what is now known as Coleman Creek, and the Julian gold rush was on.
Today, we've brought along our team of interns to tell you about the hidden treasures in this town of Julian, California, where you can relive the gold rush days nearly a century and a half ago.
Hello, this is Trevor Hill, and I'm here with historian David Lewis. Thank you for being here, David.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So I'm just going to ask you a few questions about Julian. First, I wanted to know, who are the people who founded the town?
Basically, Drury Bailey and Mike Julian were the only people who were really involved in the town. Drury had homesteaded all this land, and then in 1870, when the major hard rock mines were discovered, that's when he hired a surveyor to lay out the town. So that's when I say it started, was February of 1870.
Who was Fred Coleman?
Fred Coleman is a black man that was in the area way before Julian was founded. We have him on the San Diego County tax rolls in 1863, which is kind of interesting. That's when two the major battles of the Civil War took place. So it's right in the middle of the Civil War. So what's Fred doing here at that time period is interesting by itself. We don't have any answers to that. We probably never will. But Fred, he was apparently, according to local lore, had cattle here. He was friendly with the local Indians. We know that because he eventually married an Indian woman, Maria Jesus Anejo. Fred was apparently out looking after his cattle and stopped to water his horse in the creek. Again, this is local lore. They really expand on it sometimes, telling that he took his frying pan out of his saddlebags and all this, but we don't know any of this. We just know that Fred was the guy that discovered the gold. Apparently, Fred couldn't keep a secret because pretty quick there were a bunch of people panning in that creek. And that was placer gold, the can you do pan for in water in the creek. But it didn't last very long. And so then they started working their way up the creek to find the source of the gold. And that's when they found it in these hills north of town.
And how did the discovery of that gold change Julian?
Well, Julian didn't even exist when that gold was discovered. So that was like the launch point for everything that happened around here. When word got back that they had found successful mine workings up here, and the first loads of ore ended up downtown on display and taken up to San Francisco for milling and assaying, that launched Julian.
Wow. Do you have any colorful stories that you've heard about the gold rush or just Julian in general?
There's lots of colorful stories, but I'm the historian for the cemetery too, and people always ask me who the most interesting person from Julian that's buried in that cemetery, and it's Drury Bailey, the man that founded this town. Because when he founded this town, he went and he fought in the Civil War right after he got out of high school. Terrible deal. The family lost all of their land back there, and they end up here. And Drury homesteads all this land, and then, like I say, gets that surveyor. Drury's 26 years old when he did this. I find that pretty amazing because I was still looking for some gas for my car and hoping for a date when I was 26 years old. And this man starts a town. He made a pretty good reputation for himself as being a generous person, but he also had a lot of foresight.
Interesting. Can you tell us about this building that we're in right now, the Pioneer History Museum?
This building started out life. It was built by Joseph Treschel, who was a blacksmith, and he ran it for a few years. This was in the 1890s. And then he sold it, or leased it, I'm not sure which, to Peter Meyerhofer, who brewed beer here. And then it went back to another blacksmith, Christian Grosskopf, who blacksmithed here, and that was the last thing that I know that happened in here. It fell to ruin. All that was left are these rock walls in here. Wow. And in 1952, the Women's Club took it upon themselves to get some county money and some volunteers, and they rebuilt what you see here. Wow. So there's been a little expansion out the front, and we're doing a little expansion out the south end right now. But
so these are the original stone walls that we're seeing around
those
us?
Those right there, yes. And wow. Those were probably mined right here on site. That's Julian Schist, S-C-H-I-S-T, just to clarify that. Anyway, that is what is unique to this Julian area, and it's the quartz within that schist where the gold is found. So when they flattened this area out, they were cutting that stuff off, and it comes off in slabs because it's sedimentary, mm-hmm. and it's hard, mm-hmm. and then it's stackable. That's how these walls came about, was right from what was here.
Wow.
How often can you do that anymore?
Do you have any favorite exhibits here at the museum?
Well, probably my favorite is the Bailey exhibit, because I almost feel like family. I know as much or probably more than a lot of the family does about them, because that's been my focus. It has a few personal things in there, but my favorite one is that pick that's exhibited in there. It's not necessarily a pick that you would use for mining ore. It's for picking out samples. And he was injured in the mine in 1899, disappeared from the logbook for a while on the payroll. Mm-hmm. And when he came back, he had fashioned that pick as a cane also.
Wow.
So it's a little short, you might know. And
had a hunch, maybe.
not Drury. Drury. This is the giant founder of the town is 5'3" tall. So I've got a little picture that I did once. I photoshopped him in, me and my documentation, right? I photoshopped him in next to me and put a ruler between us just to show the difference of what we look like.
Wow. Thank you so much for answering my questions.
You're very welcome.
Anyone can come here and talk to David on Sundays you're here?
I'm usually here off and on. Okay. Lately, I've been able to get Drury's grandson, Richard Bailey. Anybody that comes up here can talk to the grandson of the founder of the town.
I have one more question. When did the mine close, the Julian mines?
All in varying stages. There was no real just shutdown. People kept piddling around. Mm-hmm. They're still out there piddling around.
Wow, really?
Yeah. You know, especially when times get hard. People mm-hmm. are out there trying to get lucky. But say from 1900, they were pretty much done. But then my grandfather's draft record shows he was a hoist operator at the Golden Chariot, and that would have been about 1918. Now we mine tourists.
Well, okay. Thank you again.
You're welcome.
Up next, we're going to have Jaden Jimenez tell us about what he found most interesting about the museum here.
While I was looking through the museum, one of the more interesting things that I found was a railroad spring. It was on a railroad cart. And what they did is they got the spring and put it in the Victorian Town Hall here in Julian. And basically, it was for the dance floor. So when there was large groups of people, they would dance and it would actually really add a springy effect. So I thought that was pretty interesting. One of the only spring floors left is actually in the Hotel del Coronado.
Wow, that's so interesting. Thank you, Jaden.
What do you think, guys? How would you like to go try your hand at some gold mining?
I'm feeling lucky.
All right, let's go.
This is Devon Marshall, and we're here at the Eagle Mine in Julian, which is open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to mid to late afternoon or so if you want to tour the mine or try your hand at panning for gold. Now I'm going to be talking to Mr. Craig Nelson, whose family owns and operates the mines, and with Kim Gordon, one of our guides today.
My grandpa, he ran this from about the late 60s all the way till he passed away. Then my dad took over, and then he passed away about 10 years ago. And then me and my brothers that took over, and we're really blessed to have a grandpa that decided not to dig the gold out of the mountain, because that's a lot harder of a job. Taking you folks through that mountain and teaching the history is a lot fun.
So then the real goal is the tourism.
Well, the education.
Okay.
I'll tell you, because the tourists that come to Julian, California, and I always, I'll tell you, the local town museum down there, which is Mr. Lewis,
right.
And those folks, and we just did Kim did a nice seminar down here at the library the other night, and you know, a lot of the kids don't realize what it takes to gold mine back in the 1870s and how they just barely made a living with this type of method. And they all want keyboards and phones and, you know, the technology of today. They don't pick up the pick and shovel and mm-hmm. you know, do 8, 10, 12-hour shifts under hard rock mining. And that's what we want to show you is It's hard to get a guy to do that kind of work anymore.
So Steven, one of our interns, is here, and he's going to try his hand at some of the panning for gold. Can you come over and give him a couple pointers on how to do this?
You want the sand to go over the ridges. That's why they make the tools. It's black to keep the metals separated. You see the colors.
Uh-huh.
So like you said, you scrape to the bottom. Now what I do, once you get it in a pan, I settle it, shake it. Because then you get control of the sand by settling the gold to the bottom of the pan. Then when you get to the gold to the bottom of the pan, you simply let the pan and the water do the work for you, because that's what it's made to do. But you know what the first gold pan used to be back in the 1800s? The gold horn. We got a gold horn in there, so what they did is cut the end of the horns off. It's a U shape, right? You'd scrape it down into the stream, and you'd rock it back and forth. The gold being heavy stays in the metal. Unfortunately, I'm not going to go cut some horn off of a steer or something like that and get the end of the horn. Take the pan, and then once you settle the gold and you're happy with it, then you just let the water in the pan wash the sand out, because the gold's heavier and it goes to the bottom.
Okay, so we have Steven over here who's been trying his hand at it. Steven,
what's his yield?
Come tell us how it's going.
It's been going good. I found myself a lot of good, and the techniques by Kim,
our favorite tour guide, one of our friends and family.
It actually works.
Yeah, ooh, look
now,
at all that.
What you want to do is concentrate. We want to see what you got as a collector. Get it all to the end of the pan, concentrate it by tapping it. Keep water in the pan. And then it separates, just like up at the mill. The sand will always go first, and the gold, being the heaviest, will drag out of the back with the black, that's the iron, separates by the metal like the mill up there. And you tap it, and you start rolling it. And the gold being heavier, we're going to chase the gold tail, as they call it. And look at how it comes and drags out the back. So now doesn't that look prettier? The
now
way that
talking.
You could look at it like that.
Eureka!
Eureka! Your gold strike. So that's what you get. That's about $10, $12 worth of a gold tail right there. Now we're going to start at the Eagle Adit, because instead of an entrance to the gold mine, they call them adits, A-D-I-T. It's a cluster puzzle.
What could we expect when we go down to do the mine tour?
Well, what we're going to expect is we're going to go over to the entrance, and we're going to learn, how do you know where to start your tunnel? Because they couldn't pan for gold with the streams drying up. So we're going to go over the mountain. We're going to look at the way that the layers and the mountain structured. And we're going to show you how they go into the mountain and abstract the gold-bearing ore, the quartz, out of the mountain. You just learned how to get the gold out of the quartz by the California 5 stand mill. Now remember, that machine would operate right on that foundation right there. And we moved it up there when my grandpa made this a tour business. That way you had two-stage tour area right there. And once you move 22 tons, you don't move it back as you go. So we're going to show you how they go through that mountain and pull out the gold-bearing ore, and you already seen how to process it. So let's go see how we can get that quartz, the gold-bearing ore, out of the mountain.
Okay, we can send our interns down into the mine. You guys ready?
Oh, yeah.
All right.
We're going to cover...
Come back. Bye.
We're going to cover...
Bye.
Yeah. Well, it's nice knowing you. We'll see you in about 50 years of being abandoned on the mountain. Okay.
This is Leon, and we're down in Julian, California, and our interns are back. How did it go on the mine shaft?
Oh, well, it was really great. We got to learn a lot of stuff, and it was really interesting, you know, learning the history. One of the coolest things that I thought that happened while we were in the mine is while we were in, you know, all the lights are on, you can see, you know, decently well, but he took us to this room where there was a candle, and he turned off all the lights, all of the lights to light up the mine, and it was complete darkness. There's no light source coming in whatsoever. And so we lit the candle so we could see how, you know, the old miners used to see just such dim light, and they had to deal with this for 10 hours a day. And so, yeah.
My favorite part of the mine tour was seeing all the gadgets that the miners used back then. And one gadget in particular was the Widowmaker, which was a nomadic drill. It was created to carve deeper into the cave. The nomadic drill would drill into the rocks, and then they would put dynamite in the holes, and the dynamite would explode, causing a lot of dust to affect the lungs of the miners, causing them to have lung cancer. And that's why they call it the Widowmaker.
Well, my favorite part of the tour was we got to this point in the mine where there was a shaft that went straight down for 425 feet, and our tour guide showed us the bucket that they used to pull ore up from the mine, and it turns out that they also used it as an elevator. And there was this huge steam-powered machine that cranked the rope, because it's such a long drop, you can't really have people trusted to hoist someone up that far. And there was a bell on the machine that was so loud, and it was to give signals. Different amounts of rings meant different things. And it was so loud and it echoed throughout the entire mine, and I just thought it was really cool.
So what do you think? So how would you guys have liked to make your living as a hard rock miner?
I'll leave that to the old-timey miner people.
Tough work, huh? Well, I bet you guys have worked up an appetite.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, walking all over town, going down the mine. All right, well, let's go find something wonderful to eat. And there's no shortage of great places to eat up here in Julian.
Especially if you're looking for apple pie. Because Julian's goal these days is the tourists that come here to enjoy this wonderful town. Let's go eat!
This is Jaden Jimenez with East County Magazine, and I'm here with Charles Scott. He works at Candied Apples and here in Julian, so can you tell us a little bit about history about Candied Apples in Julian?
You bet, yes. My name's Charles. I'm the pastry chef and owner of the Candied Apple Pastry Company in Julian. We've been here for 11 years. Julian's kind of got a very interesting history with apples. It started with the gold miners who settled in this community in the late 1800s. They found that they could grow apples very easy here. In the early 1900s, they sent a bushel of apples to one of the world expos and won a gold medal. And that put Julian on the map for apples. Of course, supply and economics changed the world of apples up here a little bit. As Julian grew, some of the apple farms were turned into housing developments, wineries, and of course some of the apple growers retired. But there's still quite a lot of apples being grown up here, from a range of apple cider apples to you-pick apples to organic apples.
And apple pies.
And apple pie. Yeah. Yeah, the apple pie history actually goes back probably to the Farmer family. Bud Farmer was an apple grower up here, and his wife used to make apple pies. This is dating back probably 40 years. As they handed off the business, Liz Smothers from the Julian Pie Company and Anita Knowles from Mom's took that over and kept the apple pie business alive up here in Julian and have kept that name quite alive. Of course, the Julian Pie Company, that works very well. Our little bakery is a European bakery and bistro concept. Of course, being in Julian, you have to make apple pie. So we do make apple pie.
Yeah,
along with many other things like 12 kinds of breads. I have a 7-year-old sourdough starter started in the French way from a white wine yeast. We do pastries, desserts, wedding cakes, catering, full-service lunch menu, and, of course, French crepes.
Wow. How did you get started with this store?
With this store? Well, this store was a transition from 35 years of hard work. I started in the industry as a young boy doing dishes. Got promoted to cooking because I said I didn't want to do dishes anymore. Worked my way through the industry, some fine hotels, did my formal training in New York at the International Pastry Arts Center. Ended up in Borrego Springs as the executive chef of a hotel there, and in there at La Casa del Zorro. And in the process of them closing down and selling out, this bakery was on the market, and I chose to buy it 8 years ago.
Wow, that's wonderful.
And it's been 8 years of quite the wild ride of producing delicious desserts, pastries, breads, wedding cakes, birthday cakes.
So, can you tell us a little bit about the community here? I know earlier you were talking about how so many people come in.
Julian's, I mean, it's like I said, it's got a very diverse history. Today, Julian has really put itself on the map as a tourist community. Anybody who comes to San Diego, is part of the program is to see Julian, hear the history of Julian. I've met people from all parts of the world, the Far East, the Mideast, quite a few European travelers, Sweden, Germany, Italian, and, of course, America. I mean, I've met people from all over the world who come in the bakery here. It's very fun.
Wow, that's really interesting. Thank you for interviewing with us. This was great. We're going to enjoy this delicious lunch. Got a few sandwiches and crepes. A
couple of paninis and some crepes, you bet. Thank you for joining us.
Candied apples, we're looking forward to trying those.
For dessert. There we go. You got to save room for dessert. Life is uncertain. Save room for dessert.
Thank you.
So we'll be back soon with another edition of On the Road in East County. We're signing off from Julian, California.
This is Miriam Raftery, producer of the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Now, if you're listening to today's show online, you may not be aware that an ice storm has damaged the transmitter high atop Monument Peak near Mount Laguna. KNSJ needs your help to get back on the air. You can donate at knsj.org to support people-powered radio for our region.
This is a public service announcement from East County Magazine. In these winter months, you can receive free alerts via email or Twitter on your mobile phone about emergencies such as flash floods, road closures, heavy snow, and other severe weather alerts, as well as wildfires, traffic reports, and more. You can sign up for this free public service at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
By next fall, refugee students may be able to apply to attend American colleges and universities. The State Department says it plans to pilot a new category for refugee admissions called a P4. P4 status would allow a group or institution to sponsor a refugee, and a university sponsorship program would allow that person to study in the U.S. and then apply for permanent residency. Laura Wagner is with the Initiative on U.S. Education Pathways for Refugee Students, part of the President's Alliance on Higher Education and Immigration. Wagner says the current foreign student visa program requires students to leave after they graduate.
Right now, we are getting the best and the brightest of the world, and then we're saying, thanks, now you have to go back to your home country, whereas this would provide an opportunity for them to stay and continue to use and share those talents with their new community in the U.S.
The Alliance recently published a report calling on the State Department to implement a P4 category this spring. Community colleges and universities, including UC Davis, would step up to offer free tuition. Philanthropic groups would cover other costs, and the State Department would aid in resettlement. Wagner says refugees deserve a shot at a brighter future in the U.S., a country founded by immigrants.
Less than 1% of refugees worldwide are able to be resettled. We have only 5% of refugees accessing higher ed.
Advocates of the pilot program say it could initially be limited to 30 students who would apply next fall and start their college classes in 2024. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
This is Miriam Raftery, producer of the East County Magazine radio show. If you would like to be the media, here's your opportunity. We're looking for some more talented volunteers for our East County Magazine radio show. So if you've got radio experience or just a great voice, or if you'd like to get experience writing scripts or special reports for the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ, we'd like to hear from you. You can call us at 619-698-7617 or send an email to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We're your community media, bringing you news from our region that reflects the public interest, not special interests. This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Priebel, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show. This is Miriam Raftery, producer of the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso. Now, if you're listening to today's show online, you may not be aware that an ice storm has damaged the transmitter high atop Monument Peak near Mount Laguna. KNSJ needs your help to get back on the air. You can donate at knsj.org to support people-powered radio for our region.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.